Well, I've called tonight's sermon, What's Love Got to Do With It? Which sounds like a good title for a song. But you'll remember we're actually looking at the gifts of the Spirit, and we're going through 1 Corinthians 12, 13 and 14. And for those of you who've got good memories, we actually looked at this chapter not so long ago. So for many of you, it might just be a refresher. For some of you who perhaps weren't here, it might be something new, but it's one of these chapters which you were very, very familiar with, aren't we? This whole chapter on love. Probably the most requested reading at people's weddings, and it's probably one of the most well-known passages in the whole of the Bible, because of its subject matter, I guess. But over the past few weeks, we've been looking at Paul's teaching on spiritual gifts. And, you know, some people think when we get to chapter 13, you know, Paul goes off on a bit of an aside almost, or a tangent, and sort of forgets the main subject that he's talking about and goes off to talk about love and then comes back to gifts afterwards. That's not quite true, because this passage, this chapter, is an integral part of his whole discourse on the gifts. Although this chapter obviously stands on its own when you think about what it's talking about in love, but it's actually very much an integral part of his whole discourse on the gifts in general. Just a quick recap then over what we have looked at so far. If you've missed the sermons, they're actually now available on the internet on our website, so if you've missed any of them, you can go there and download them and catch up if you've missed any. But if you remember, we've looked at the gifts, and we looked through chapter 12, didn't we, about the spiritual gifts, and we realised how they're to be used for the common good. That's the first of the key points in Paul's passage here. They're to be used for the common good. They're for the edification of the church. They're not there for individual edification. They're there to edify and to build up and to encourage the church. Certainly, the use of the gifts helps us individually, but that's not their purpose. Their purpose are there for the common good. We saw too, didn't we, that they're given for, or as the Spirit determines. It's God's prerogative to give us the gifts that he wants us to have. Not the ones we think we ought to have or we think somebody else should have. He gives the gifts as he determines. It's his prerogative. We also saw, didn't we, that as part of the body of Christ in the use of the gifts, we're not independent of one another, but rather we're interdependent on one another. We're part of the body. And we only fulfil the work that God has for us if we work together. And if one of us is not doing what we should do, ultimately that affects everybody else too. We're not doing the work God has called us to do. And last time we looked at, if you like, some of the structure in the church, and we saw that certain gifts are foundational gifts necessary for the building of a church right from the start. We saw that apostles set up the churches. We saw that through the preaching of the word, churches were established, and then along come prophets and teachers who build up the church and bring God's word to us. And after this, the church may have other gifts, and God may give other gifts to the church, but not necessarily all of the gifts all of the time. God gives the gifts as and when they're needed, not just because they're there. Well, now Paul goes on to explain what he calls the most excellent way, the way of love. And as I said, he's not digressing from the theme of spiritual gifts. This is actually very important to what he's going to say in the next chapter, actually. It's central to his whole argument, because he's been detailing in chapter 12 the purpose of the gifts, and he's going on to put them right, really, over the misuse of the gifts. And in between, we have this passage on love, because love is the most important thing. When we're talking about spiritual gifts, not just spiritual gifts, but the church generally, the building up of the church, love is the most important thing. And he says it is the most excellent way. As we said, the gifts are there to build up the body of the church. That's their purpose. And if they're used properly, that's what will happen. But the gifts themselves are not completely effective in doing that. And there's something that he's telling us here that is more effective than simply using the gifts in the church. And love is that most excellent way. It is the excellent way to build up the church. The gifts have their place, but only when they're used in love will they be truly effective. He actually goes on and continues by giving us some examples of the gifts he's mentioned already to reinforce this idea. He, again, talks about tongues. The first gift he mentions is tongues. The tongues of men and angels, he says. If I speak in the tongues of men and angels, but have not love. It's funny how he should use this example, when so far in all of his arguments, he's played this gift down as being of lesser importance to the other gifts. It's not as important, he says, as prophecy and teaching. So why does he use this as his first example? It's not a random selection. He picks this because this is the gift the Corinthian church had placed a high priority on and were misusing the most. You know, some people have said that because Paul refers here to tongues of men and angels, that this proves that the gift of tongues is in fact an angelic language. Well, I've got to say, I think that such a conclusion based on the passage here is a bit of wishful thinking on some people's part. Whether or not you believe in tongues to be a heavenly language, and we'll come back to that later, all I can say is that you can't base that on this verse. Because what Paul is using here is what's known as hyperbole in his structure of his sentences. He's reinforcing his argument in this way. What he's saying, he's taking extremes to prove his point. He's saying things like, if I could do the impossible and I don't have love, it would be a waste of time. But of course, we can't do the impossible. Only God can do the impossible. We certainly can't. If it were possible to speak in all known earthly languages, which I don't think anybody does, not even Helen, who does a few, if it were possible to speak in the language of angels, again, that's impossible for us. Even if we could do those things, without love, it would be a waste of time. We don't even know if angels have their own language. Scripture doesn't tell us that. Angels, when they appear in the Bible, tend to speak in the language of the person they're talking to. So, I don't know of any angelic language anyway. But the point is, if we could do these things, which we can't, without love, it would still be a waste of time. He says if we could speak in these languages and have not love, it would be like a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. The word that's translated in the NIV as gong is better translated as brass or bronze. The Corinthian, Corinth as a city was famous for its bronzes. They had made many gongs and cymbals in this city, and to hear the sound of gongs and cymbals echoing throughout the city wouldn't have been unusual, especially in places of worship. In some of the cults, it was particularly important. They used to stir the people up into a frenzy by banging gongs and cymbals. And that happens in some places today, in some religious formats, places like Africa still today, doesn't it? But things like gongs and cymbals make a lot of noise, but in themselves there's no melody, is there? They might be very loud, they might grab our attention, but on their own they're not exactly pleasing to the ear. Only when they're used in conjunction with other instruments do they really serve a musical purpose. So actually Paul's making a very clever point here about the use of tongues and love. You see, you cannot show love by speaking in a language that cannot be understood. Languages the hearer cannot understand are nothing more than noise to the people who hear them. But the Corinthians have got so wrapped up in this gift, they've forgotten the purpose of it. And if you remember, we went back to chapter 12, the purpose of this gift was primarily to speak God's message to a people in their own language. So instead of using this gift effectively in love, Paul's saying what you're doing is making a lot of noise. And it's a waste of time. You're not doing it in love. So having planted a few more ideas about the gift of tongues, which he will come back to again in chapter 14, he then goes on to stress the importance of love a bit further. He's already stated, hasn't he, the importance of prophecy in the church, but now he clarifies that by saying, even prophecy without love is of no value. Not only that, but if you could fathom all the mysteries there are in the world, if you could know everything there is to know, if you could have the greatest faith there is, without love, it is of no real value. No one can speak in all the languages of the world, let alone heavenly ones, not even with the gift of tongues. No one can fathom all mysteries. You know, science is still trying to do that, isn't it? You know, even with the gift of wisdom, some things still remain a mystery. We might have the gift of knowledge, but we're not going to know everything there is to know. And not even the gift of faith gives us faith in the fullest degree. Paul here refers to all faith. All the faith there could possibly be. All the faith that it would be possible to have. You see, Paul's conclusion, where he just mentions these things, is that even if it were possible for him to have all these gifts and to do all these things, without love, it would be nothing. It would be worthless. It would be a complete waste of time. The Corinthians put great emphasis on these gifts. The people that had them were thought of as highly spiritual people. And some of them may have grown full of their own self-importance because they had certain gifts. And the same things happen today. You know, you find people sometimes in positions of perhaps a spiritual authority, they become full of their own self-importance. But Paul was very emphatic here. The Christian who might have all the gifts it's possible to have and yet does not have love is quite worthless. He goes on then, having talked about the importance of love in respect of the gifts that we have, he stresses the point further in verse 3 by referring to what we do. You might sell everything you've got and give it all to the poor, but if you do it without love, it's a waste of time. You may even go as far as giving up your life, but if it's done without love, it's a futile gesture. It means nothing. Sounds a bit harsh, really, doesn't it, when you think about it? You know? Why is it that things done without the love he's talking about are still of no value? Surely making sacrifices like this have some intrinsic value of their own. I suppose it comes down to what you want to receive from the sacrifices you make. If all you want is to be put on a pedestal, men's approval, people to think well of you, then you may well gain that. But if it's God's approval you're after, then only if it's love that motivates you will God be pleased with what you do. You know, I could find somebody out on the street and I could give them some money to get a meal maybe, so they could have a decent meal. And I could make sure that people knew I'd done it. I could make a big thing of it. You know, I could come to church and tell people and share how nice I'd been that week and how I'd helped this person out, this poor person out on the street, and I'd given them some money to help them get a meal. And everybody would think, wow, isn't Don a wonderful person? You know, he's a real, real nice chap to do that, isn't he? Alternatively, what I could do is decide that I'd still like to help that person out, because I have a love for God and I have a love for people. But rather than seek a pat on the back, I'd give them that same amount of money and I'd do it, you know, quietly, secretly, and not draw attention to myself. And I wouldn't come and tell all of you that I'd done it. Now, the result for the person is exactly the same. They had the money. They got their nice meal from it. The difference is what I get out of it. I'll either receive the praise of men or the praise of God. If I do it for the wrong reason, then as far as my spiritual life is concerned, I've gained nothing. It's of no benefit to me whatsoever. See, men's praises don't count for any reward in God's kingdom. I'm not saying that we have to just creep around the whole time as Christians and do everything in secret that nobody ever spots what we're doing. But what matters is what motivates us in the first place. When you really love someone, you will do whatever you can for that person. You will do whatever you can for that person without wanting to look good or to get something in return. You do it simply because you love them and because you want the best for them. And that should be our attitude as Christians. We should be motivated to do the good things that God wants us to do by the love, firstly, that we have for God, and secondly, that love expressed to the people around us. And if that's our motivation, that is what God is pleased with. So I suppose the big question is, what is love? What is love? A question people like to ponder over. Well, let me say what it's not in this context to start with. It's not a sentimental, slushy, sloppy sort of love based on our feelings for someone. This is a love that is willing to die for the people that hate you. That's the sort of love we're talking about. It's a love that has a concern for your enemies as well as your friends. It's a love that rises above the way that we feel. And it's a love that we can only get from God. Now, we use the word love in all sorts of situations, don't we? We might say that we love chocolate. And some of us really do. But of course, that's different to the way we might love our husbands or our wives. At least I hope it is. And of course, as you know, the Greeks had several words for love, and this is nothing new to you, I'm sure. But they had different meanings used when they used these different words. The word philio is, of course, brotherly love. It's the love of friendship and companionship. Eros is more of a passionate, sexual type of love. But when the early Christian writers came to write about God's love, these words, and there are other Greek words as well, less common ones, these words didn't say what they wanted to say about God's love. And they actually eventually found this obscure word, it's called agape. And that's the word they chose to use. And if you go back through lots of ancient writings, you'll probably find that this word is almost exclusively used in Christian writings from the time. It's hardly ever used elsewhere in the Greek. And it's a word Christians used to describe a love that was different to any other love the Greeks knew about. And only in this way could they adequately or even begin to describe God's love. You see, it's not based on the way we feel about someone. It's not based on an emotional response. This is a love that is based on an act of will. It is a love that has to rise above the way that we feel. You know, we all have this tendency, don't we, to want to get our own back on people. Somebody upsets us, we want to get our own back on them. We want to, you know, make sure that they get what they gave to us. If when you're a little child, somebody comes along and breaks your toy, your first reaction is to go along and break one of theirs because you want to get back at them. We all like to have last hit, don't we? If somebody annoys me with their driving, I'll run at their tail after them, you know, don't like them doing that to me. And road rage is a classic example of this, isn't it? I want to make them pay for what they've done. And I guess all of us have had those feelings to some degree or another. Well, God's love is about not giving in to such feelings. It's not about getting our own back. Instead, we should seek to do good. It's easy to love the people we like and the people we get on with, or most of the time anyway. It's much harder to love our enemies. It's much harder to love those people that don't love us. But can you imagine where we'd be today if God's love for us was based on his feelings towards us? The Bible tells us that God hates sin. Now, some people say this saying that God hates the sin yet loves the sinner. And there is some truth in that, but you don't find it in the Bible. As far as God is concerned, the Bible tells us we are not just sinners, we are sin. That's how God sees us. Not just people who sin, but we are in fact sin in the sight of God. And God's wrath is upon us because of that. And if you like, that's the way God feels about us. His wrath is upon us because we have sinned against him, and righteous judgment deserves a punishment. And we could have no complaints if God left us to that punishment. Eternal separation from him. Hell. But God didn't leave it there. You know, for some inexplicable reason, he chose to love us. He chose to allow his son to be sacrificed so that we might be saved. And that is the extent of God's love. He didn't just say he loved us. He proved it by what he did. I wonder if any of us would be prepared to let somebody we love be killed in such a terrible way. For somebody who despised us and rejected us. For somebody who hated us and constantly did everything they could to fight against us. Would you be prepared to let someone you love die for such a person? That's what God did. That's the sort of love we're talking about in this chapter. So how does this affect us? Well, as the church, we need this love. It binds us together. You know, the church is made up of all sorts of strange people. And you need to look around the room and you can see that's true. And we've all got those rough edges, you know, and we don't really fit together that well, do we? Sometimes we rub each other up the wrong way. We don't fit maybe in a nice, easy way. And I've told you the story of my wall before, where you get all the bricks and you can start building a wall. But if you don't have any cement between the bricks, it all falls apart. And the bricks don't fit properly. The cement is the bit in the middle that holds it all together. That overlooks the rough edges, that fills in the gaps, that helps the bricks stick together. And that's what love is to the church. Love is the church's cement. It fits in between us and helps us to be bound together. You can start to build a church, but without love, it won't last very long. It won't mean anything. It won't serve any real purpose. If you read through verses 4 down to 6 or 7 down there, I'm not going to go through all of that tonight, because I want to try and get through this chapter tonight, but just read those verses there, and where it says love, put your name, and see how you measure up when you put your name in there. It's a good thing to do, and then we can think about how much love we really have. But verse 8 tells us that love never fails. It never fails. It never ceases. It never gives up. It never ends. You know, our love for people does often change depending on the way we feel about them, doesn't it? How often have we seen people in relationships who have a genuine affection and a love for one another, and yet something happens in that relationship and it can turn around so quickly, almost to the point, well, sometimes even hatred. How do you know if someone loves you? The way to know if someone loves you is by what they do, by their actions, not just by their words. And if you've had the privilege of knowing somebody love you unconditionally, then you know what real love is. Because even when you fall out and have arguments, even when things aren't always right, that love is still there. You see, a love that's based solely on feelings will only survive as long as the feeling itself. God's love is eternal. Nothing can change it. Nothing can remove it. Nothing can destroy it. And that's a real encouragement to us, because God has set his love upon us. And it doesn't matter what we do. As long as we come to God in repentance, God's love is upon us and it will never, ever change. And we can do nothing to change it. His love is permanent and it will never, ever end. But Paul goes on to contrast this love, which is eternal, with the gifts, which are transitory. The gifts will pass away. They have a particular use for a particular situation. We've seen already, haven't we, how the gifts, or not all of the gifts, are required all of the time. And Paul now takes that argument one stage further. Prophecies, he says, will cease. And this is the gift that Paul has already suggested is the most important for the church to have. But he points out that even this is temporary. He uses a very interesting Greek word here, kartagio, which Bible translators had trouble translating. It's a word used 27 times in the New Testament, and it's used 4 times in the space of 4 verses here. And in various versions of the Bible, it's been translated at least 80 different ways. It's a word that people do struggle with. The general idea behind this word is to render something idle, to do away with, to abolish, to finish, to end, to become of no effect or obsolete, etc. So in what way will prophecy cease? Well, there are 2 ways in which prophecies could be regarded as ceasing. One is when individual prophecies are fulfilled. Now, for example, maybe if as a fellowship we needed to know something specific from God and he told us through a prophecy, once we've acted upon that message, then the prophecy itself is fulfilled and finished. And some prophecy, like in Acts chapter 11, where Agabus predicted a severe famine, that prophecy was fulfilled once that famine had actually happened, and that happened in the reign of Claudius. So prophecy could be regarded as ceasing when the subject of that prophecy is fulfilled or completed. Or, secondly, prophecy could be regarded as ceasing when there is no longer any need for prophecy, i.e. the gift will cease, not just the prophecy. And of course this is where the big debate is today, or not just today, but over countless days, whether or not prophecy is still valid for today. And I'll come back to that in a minute. Tongues will be stilled. So you may say the same thing about tongues. Whereas prophecy was the gift Paul regarded as the most important, the Corinthians thought that tongues was the most important gift to have. So Paul stresses again that this gift too is temporary. He uses a different word here. He uses the word pau, which means to pause, or to end, to finish. And again, the message that's brought to a person in their own tongue may be fulfilled when that person hears or acts upon that message. Or once again, maybe it's the gift itself that will cease. Knowledge will pass away. Back to that word, kartagio. Why does he pick on knowledge? We've seen he regarded prophecy as important. The Corinthians thought tongues was important. Why knowledge? Well, no doubt, if you know your history, the Greeks placed knowledge above everything else. Gnosis is the Greek word for knowledge. And the Greek society placed the idea of knowledge above everything else. To gain knowledge was the most important thing if you were a Greek. That's what their philosophers spent all their time doing, discussing how they could improve their knowledge. So again, Paul's picking on something that was regarded as very important in the society that he's referring to. And again, he's pointing out its temporary nature. Is he talking about knowledge in general or the gift of knowledge? Doesn't matter, actually. Like prophecy and tongues, knowledge is temporary. Both the gift and the knowledge that it brings will one day cease. The point Paul is making here is that whereas love is eternal, these other things in which people were placing a higher emphasis were temporary. The most important thing in any fellowship is not the gifts we have or how much head knowledge we've gained, but how much love do we have and how do we express it? Because what we know and what is revealed, Paul says, is partial. Things, even through prophecy, that are revealed to us are partial. God does not tell us everything. He only tells us what he wants us to know at any given time. You know, we think that we're pretty clever, don't we, mankind? We've discovered all sorts of things. We've gained lots of knowledge. We've split the atom. We've put a man on the moon. And yet the more we find out, the more there seems to be that we don't know. The further we delve into the microscopic, the more fantastic it appears and forces scientists to amend their theories. The further we look into space, the smaller we seem to be. All these things, the science of these things, is being constantly revised in the light of new information. The more we find out, the more we realise how limited our knowledge really is. But Paul says that will all change when perfection comes. When perfection comes, the imperfect will disappear. That word kartagio again. So what is perfection? And again, this is the big debate, isn't it, about the gifts of prophecy and tongues being for today. Hinges on this little verse, or these few verses. One view, of course, is that perfection is the completion of the scriptures. The word translated perfect here is teleos in Greek, which means complete or finished. So the idea is that things like prophecy in tongues are only temporary, at best partial, and will cease when what is complete, i.e. the scriptures, come along. Which leads to the conclusion that gifts like prophecy and tongues are not for today, because we have everything we need in the Bible, and there is no need for any further revelation. The other view would suggest that the perfect will be when Jesus returns, and when we enter eternity with him. And in the meantime, we have need of all the gifts, including the gifts of prophecy and tongues, for the church to work effectively. Well, who is right? We're going to get a clue from what Paul says next. He goes on to use this illustration about childhood. And he's really talking about maturity as a Christian now. He says, when you grow up, when you mature as a person, things that were important in your childhood are no longer so important. Childish things are left behind or finished. And that's the fourth word of that use of that word, kartagio. You know, I loved my first bike when I was a kid. It was great. I had training wheels, so I could not fall off. It was brilliant. Loved it. Used to go wherever. Eventually, the training wheels came off and I could ride around. But I'd have a real job riding that bike today, because it was fairly small, and I've grown a little bit since that time. And so that bike that I had in my childhood, I've left it behind. It wouldn't serve the same purpose today. And as you look back over your life, hopefully you'll look back and see how you've matured. The things you did in your childhood are very often gone. And it should be the same for the church. The church should be growing and maturing. Things that are important in establishing a fellowship become less important as that fellowship grows and other things become of greater significance. And here Paul again is laying the foundation of what he's going to go and talk about in the next chapter. He's going to tell the Corinthians to grow up, effectively, in chapter 14. He's going to tell them to stop worrying about the childish things and to move on to Christian maturity. And that's what should be happening. But even if we are moving on, if we are maturing, it's still not over. Paul goes on to compare the now and the then. And the then he's talking about is when perfection comes. He says we see a poor reflection in a mirror now. That's how we see things. But then we shall see face to face. I'm sure there are better people to talk about mirrors here tonight than I am, but I'll do my best. I mentioned earlier how Corinth was famed for its bronzes. Well, it was also famous for its mirrors. But mirrors in those days weren't like we have mirrors today. Mirrors then were made of polished metal, not glass. And the best mirrors were, of course, the best quality metal and the most highly polished. And only the rich could really afford such wonderful mirrors. But for the majority of Christians at Corinth, they'd have been used to seeing a reflection of themselves which was a fairly poor reflection, not a really good one. It would have probably been quite dark and quite dull. And Paul is saying to them that what they currently see and know about God is like that. But as they move on, things will become clearer. If you like, as you polish the metal, the reflection becomes a bit better. But he says, only when you see face to face will it be fully clear. Now, even the best of mirrors can only give you a two-dimensional image. And that's back to front. But Paul makes it personal. He says, now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. Even the Apostle Paul didn't know fully, but he was sure that one day he would. And that word fully can be translated perfectly. I will know perfectly, even as I am perfectly known. So I think what Paul's referring to is the time when he will meet with Jesus face to face. When he will know Jesus fully, even as Jesus knows him. Now we only know in part. There's still much God has not revealed to us. The time that Paul's talking about, the then he's talking about, is that when he and the rest of us will reach glory, because only then will we know fully as we are fully known. But there's this twist at the end, isn't there? And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. So is he saying that only these three remain, and the other gifts, like prophecy and tongues, are done away with? Well, that would lead us to the conclusion, wouldn't it? That if only faith, hope, and love remain, there's no place for gifts of teaching and preaching and administration, for wisdom. The gifts may be temporary, unlike love, but nevertheless, there's no suggestion here that they are done away with until Christ returns and we see him face to face. We may not require all of the gifts all of the time, but to suggest that they're no longer available is to limit God in what he can do with his church. So why does he pick out these three at the end? He's actually summarising what he's been trying to point out all the way through: the contrast between the temporary and the eternal. And the most important thing is that which lasts forever. Faith is what brings us into an eternity with God. You must have faith to become a Christian. And it is through faith that we are saved, through faith that we are justified, through faith that we are made righteous. It is faith that brings us into eternal life. Hope is what sustains us throughout this world into eternity. Hope sustains us through the temporary into the eternal. The hope we have is in God. It's the hope of eternal salvation. It is the hope of our home to come in glory. But love will last throughout eternity. Faith brings us to eternity. Hope sustains us through the temporary into eternity. They won't be needed when we meet Jesus face to face. But love will last throughout eternity. And that is why love is the greatest thing of all. It is the only thing we will need when we meet God face to face. It is the only thing we will take with us into eternity. The gifts are important to the building up of the church. But love is the most excellent way to build up the church. Only when the gifts are used in the context of love will they be truly effective for the purpose that God has given them to us.